And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's an exciting day here on the program. Intriguing passing of the guard, if you will, or a passing of the baton. For 18 years, our good friend Nan Calvert helped arrange environmentally themed morning shows once a month for 18 years and did such a terrific job. At one point recently, Nan started to feel like, well, maybe it's time for somebody else to step in with, you know, maybe a different perspective, fresh perspective. And she approached Kaylin Palomares, who is on the staff at Hawthorne Hollow. And we're going to let Kaylin talk a little bit about that. But to make a long story short, or maybe not so long a story, Kaylin said yes and has very happily stepped into this role that Nan Calvert has so capably played for the last 18 years. And so, and for this very first time on the morning show, Kaylin has with her actually the executive director of Hawthorne Hollow, TJ Levesque. And we're going to be talking about a number of things, but primarily talking about the happy time at Hawthorne Hollow of maple sugaring and what's going on right now and kind of the ins and outs of all of that. So first of all, Kaylin Palomares, we welcome you to the morning show and to WGTD.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Great to have you here. And TJ Levesque, we will get to you very, very shortly, but really glad that you're here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, it's great to have you here, even on this rainy day. So Kaylin, just briefly, let's hear a little bit about that moment when Nan reached out to you one way or another with this invitation. Tell us what she what that invitation was like and so on.
So Nan emailed me kind of a nerve-wracking email when I first started reading it. You know, I first started reading it, it said, I've been thinking a lot and things along that line, and that's always something that makes you nervous. It's what's happening? Are you moving? What's going on? But no, she had basically just said that, you know, she's been doing this for a very long time, and she's been thinking about, you know, focusing on actually being retired and hanging out at her farm. And so, you know, it's a lot of work. So she had approached me and asked me if I wanted to take this over for her. And like you said earlier, it was an immediate yes, but I had to make sure that all my ducks were in a row, especially with work. And so thanks to TJ, I'm able to do something like this. And obviously, I don't want to fill everybody's airwaves with only Hawthorne Hollow things, but I thought it would be a natural start to talk Hawthorne Hollow today.
Absolutely. I'm really glad that we get to do that. And ahead of today's conversation, I think because it is your first time visiting us in this capacity, you've been on the program several times before this, of course, but let's get from you just a brief biographical sketch, if you will, of where you are from originally, and maybe a little bit about how your interest in and love of the natural world, where that sort of came from or originated.
Sure. So I'm born and raised in Racine or Sturtevant, and I've been there my entire life. I was in Kenosha for a very brief period of time and came back. I, growing up, went camping a lot, and I think that that's what kind of started my interest in the natural world, but I didn't know that you could make a career out of it and that you could do that for your job until I was a senior in high school. So it took me a long time to figure out exactly the fact that I could do this. Originally, as a kid, I wanted to be a meteorologist because that was close.
Really?
Yeah, I wanted to, you know, be the person telling everybody the weather that everyone gets mad at. You know, as I grew, I kind of realized, you know, I like to be outside. I like to tell people about, you know, nature. So I ended up going to UW Parkside for environmental studies and geography, and through a lot of internships with the city of Racine and the zoo, things like that, I ended up here at Hawthorne Hollow. So,
and when is it that you started at Hawthorne Hollow?
I started in 2021, towards the end, like September.
Very good. Explain to our listeners exactly what your position is there. I think I know you're a naturalist, and I don't know if you're the naturalist or a naturalist, and I know you're something else.
Yes. So I am the naturalist and the only naturalist there, and the education manager. Those kind of go hand in hand, but essentially I run the outdoor education programming of almost all capacities. So we do field trip programming. We do adult and family, so more for any age group, even adults only things. And then this year we're actually starting summer camp as well. So that's a whole new area that I'm kind of touching on. So it's really awesome and really fulfilling to kind of do what I love and get to tell the kids about what I love. So it's
absolutely
awesome.
And what exactly do you do as Hawthorne Hollow's naturalist?
So a lot. We all wear many, many hats. But essentially what I'm doing is I am preparing, planning, scheduling any educational aspect of Hawthorne Hollow. So again, the field trips, the adult and family programs. I'm the one teaching them and leading them, unless I have a very large group, in which case some of our other staff steps in, which is I'm very thankful for that. Mm-hmm. Again, with wearing many hats, like yesterday I was out chainsawing some branches that fell on some trails and had to clear them and move them. Mm. Sometimes I'm writing grants. I am helping a wedding ceremony figure out where the ceremony location is. So it's a wide range, but essentially the education is the main component of what I do.
Got it. Very good. So TJ Levesque, your boss, the executive director of Hawthorne Hollow, is with us as well, and I'm so glad TJ can join us. We should maybe mention that you actually had lined up another colleague from Hawthorne Hollow to be joining us. So
yeah, poor Laura. So I did plan on having Laura Smith here. She is actually our rentals and marketing manager at Hawthorne Hollow, but for the month of March, she takes on the role of Sugar Shack manager. So she manages our Sugar Shack and actually helps out with the programming. And we'll talk a little bit about the Sugar Shack in a little bit, but she unfortunately has a flu. So Laura, if you're listening, hope you're feeling better.
Get better.
Yeah.
This is a busy time to be sick.
That's right.
So anyway, but TJ Levesque is joining us. And before we get into the whole maple sugaring thing, TJ, remind our listeners about when you came aboard as executive director at Hawthorne Hollow, and maybe a little bit about where you come from originally.
Okay. It's funny. I actually started out. We depend on our volunteers for so much work at Hawthorne Hollow. We're so thankful for our volunteers. And I actually started out as a volunteer in, 2007. My friend called me and said, hey, do you want to come in and help me install benches and volunteering? So we installed the benches in the amphitheater. And this is great. And that's when I really discovered Hawthorne Hollow. And I interviewed a few times for a few different positions. And I finally got in as grounds curator back in April Fool's Day of 2011. And then I just got experience in all the different corners, and in 2020, that great year 2020, things kind of we ended up looking for an executive director, and I was there and kind of fell into it.
Sometimes we fall into the happiest of things, so that's great. I think the last time you were on the morning show, you've been on a couple of times, was because of kind of an exciting expansion at Hawthorne Hollow. Remind our listeners about that.
Yeah, last year was such a big year for Hawthorne Hollow. We are always 40 acres since Ruth and Margaret Teuscher bought the property in 1935 and deeded it over to the Hyslop Foundation in 1967. We were 40 acres, but in 2016, we expanded. We doubled in size to 90 acres. We acquired 50 acres adjacent land to the south of us. We're donated to us. So we spent a good 6 years developing trails, developing programs, incorporating that. And finally, this past year, 2023, we're able to open those trails up to the public, presenting a new map. We also, last year, we also had the Thursday Morning Club, overlooking the Hollow. Some big accomplishments last year. Many things going on there at Hawthorne Hollow, but hey, it's been beautiful weather lately. And if you're listening out there, come on out. The trails are open. Today's kind of muddy, but the trails are open. We're open Tuesday through Sunday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Right. Very good. I'm trying to remember, Kaylin, I saw you that day that you were first taking people on the brand new trails. Was there literal ribbon cutting that day? I mean, I know that's how it was billed.
Yes, we did do a ribbon cutting, and the scissors were not cooperating with the ribbon cutting, which is very telling of us and how things go for a nonprofit. Right. But it was very exciting. There's a lot of people there to celebrate that grand opening. And, you know, Lori, our TMO, who did a lot of that work in that new property, she was our old restoration ecologist. She was there for that, and that was very special. And then our new ecologist, Emily, as well, kind of did that ribbon cutting together. So it was a very awesome, special day. We had great weather that day too. It was pretty perfect. So cool. We've seen a lot of people visiting those new trails, and it's very fulfilling to see people out there.
Very good. All right. Well, Kaylin, the thing that you wanted to talk about today on the morning show, and it was hoped to be with Laura, but we will have to have her another time, was this thing called maple sugaring. So first of all, just explain why you thought this would be a fun topic to kind of explore. And I think it's one we've barely touched on over the years.
Yeah, so it's kind of environmentally adjacent. It's not directly like we're talking about climate change or we're talking about native plants. But it's still very involved and still very natural resource based, literally. So the month of March specifically is generally when people in this area are doing maple sugaring. And so it's very close to me, and I feel very comfortable talking about it and talking with others about it. And so I figured for the first show, it all made sense for to be here in March, to, you know, talk about maple sugaring, and it's perfect. So yeah.
I agree. So how long has maple sugaring been part of Hawthorne Hollow? I mean, an important part of what happens there.
So I believe that the first year Hawthorne Hollow did it was 2011, and that was without a sugar shack and without many of the things that we have now, our tools and equipment. And then there was a grant written for a sugar shack, which is very important because that's where we actually cook it down to syrup. And if you're doing that inside or in a garage, it could be very time-consuming and messy and sticky, so having a dedicated space was really important. So in 2012, we were able to get a grant and a few other funders to help fund our Sugar Shack, which is now called Mary's Sugar Shack, after Mary Frost Ashley Foundation. And so basically, soft start was 2011, and the official was probably 2012, so...
Very good. So one of the reasons it made sense to for you to invite TJ Levesque is, in a sense, plan B, is because TJ, if I understand, you've done plenty of maple sugaring over the years, and some of your first experiences at Hawthorne Hollow involved it. Is that right?
Actually, yeah. Back in 2011, yeah, I was interviewed in 2011 in March. Jeez, this is what, 13 years ago now, 14 years ago?
Wow.
And my interview took place in front of the old director and the old ecologist, Joe and Lori, and they were actually evaporating sap over lasagna pans, you know, because we didn't have the sugar shack yet. So I go, oh, this is neat. This is, you know, looks like a fun experience. And yeah, if you've been to Hawthorne Hollow, you know, you're driving down the main entrance, and there's giant sugar maple trees all along the entrance. So, you know, a naturalist that worked at River Edge, Nancy Carlson, said, hey, you guys should be doing maple sugaring. You have all these maple trees. So she helped us develop the programs, and we tap 120 maple trees a year.
About 100.
100 maple
trees. Give or take.
And a good year, 120 maybe.
Yes.
So... this is a process that I think most of us don't know anything about. I mean, most of us, all we do is enjoy the syrup and don't even think all that much about where it came from. So talk us through the process. I mean, where does this all, in a sense, begin?
So the important part, again, is that we do this during the month of March. So we have this freezing and thawing generally between the day and the nighttime. So below freezing at night, above freezing during the day, generally. Now, obviously, this year has been very weird, which we'll touch on. But essentially, you need that freezing and thawing in order for the sap to flow the way that we need to collect it. And so it's a very complicated process that we're still figuring out. Ourselves and also scientists in general are still trying to figure out how that sap is actually moving through the tree. But we know that we need at least that freezing and thawing. And so we are tapping our trees at this time. We're collecting the sap. And many people don't understand that it doesn't come out of the tree looking like syrup. It doesn't come out being brown and tasting that way. It has to be boiled. You have to boil away the water to leave those sugars and leave that flavor in order for it to actually be syrup. So that's one of the, I think, biggest surprises, especially with kids. But sometimes you get adults, too, that are very surprised to see a bucket that looks like water on our trees.
Because that's what it is before you've done what you need to do with it.
Yeah, it's 98% water, so it's very water adjacent.
Interesting.
Yeah, we actually have the in the field trips, we have the students taste the sap right out of the tree, and we let it drip on their tongue if they're brave enough to, you know, not lick the spile. But they have to like really look for that sweetness, because it, like Kaylin said, it's mostly water, so it's a little bit sweet. Sometimes I fill my coffee cup up with some sap, but it's a great time of year to be drinking the sap.
Right, but it's not what you put on your pancakes by any means. So, so here's a good naturalist question for you, Kaylin. What function does the sap play in the tree? I mean, in a sense, why is that sap there, or what does the sap do?
It's a great question. Yeah, it's not just there for us to cook down to syrup, right? It's obviously there's sugars there, right? So for most plants, their sugar is their energy, and they make those sugars with photosynthesis on their leaves. So the sap that's in the tree at this time of year is stored sugars from kind of the year prior, and it's storing them to stay alive basically through the winter, through dormancy. So the sap running through the tree is essentially like the blood or the food of the tree. I kind of compare it to both. And it's just keeping it going, and until those buds open up, it's stored energy. So as the season goes on, we've noticed that the sap has less sugar content, and we think that that's because it's about to put out buds, so it's starting to lose some of that energy, I guess.
Diverting it or something. Yeah. So when you are tapping a tree, and we'll talk about what that exactly is, but are you in a sense harming the tree or debilitating it in any way, or is this a fairly natural part of the life of a tree in a sense?
It's a little controversial. Not crazy, but it's just originally when maple sugaring was kind of discovered, it was discovered by the Native Americans, and they didn't fully understand at the beginning that the sap, you could get the sap from a little teeny hole, or you could get the sap from making a huge gash in the tree. So originally there was these big V-shaped gashes being put in the tree to collect the sap. And then as the trees started to dwindle in life, they realized maybe we don't need to make this big of a hole, so to speak, in the tree. So over time, humans have figured out like they're getting smaller and smaller with the hole that they're putting in the tree. Obviously, trees in a forest or in any setting are going to be dealing with injuries over its lifetime. It's kind of natural in that way, where it's going to heal itself, and it creates scar tissue, which we call belly buttons because they look like human belly buttons. That's for the kids. But when it heals itself, you can't tap that area anymore. So eventually there's a limit to how much you can tap a tree, and the health of the tree also. So we kind of monitor the health as we're doing our programs to say, like, that tree's not looking good this year, we're going to give it a break, maybe we won't tap that one again. Whereas very healthy trees could be tapped 2-3 times if you wanted. We generally limit it to 2. So
right. So you were squabbling about exactly how many trees there are on the property of Father Nalo, but certainly 100, maybe more. Do you know very much about how those got there? I mean, do you have any idea if they were purposefully planted there, or did they just sort of happen?
So sugar maple trees are what we tap at Hawthorne Hollow exclusively, and they happen to be native. So our woods have a lot of maple sugar trees in them, sugar maple trees in them, sorry. And sugar maples are actually shade tolerant, so they'll grow in the sun, they'll grow in the shade, straight up. Straight up mean like a toothpick straight up, as opposed to cherry trees that are kind of wiggly and wobbly. But they will grow, and they kind of outcompete other trees, so we have to manage our maple trees. But if you've been to Hawthorne Hall, like I said, the driveway going in, the sisters, Ruth and Margaret Toysher, they planted those trees back when they were starting the arboretum, actually before they were starting the arboretum in the 50s. So those, the trees were planted by the sisters of Sarah Hawthorne Hollow, and they probably just took them right from the, you know, saplings growing in the woods, because they grow native here.
Very good. So let's talk about this process called tapping, which is interesting, and it sounds like the means by which that is done, you know, varies a bit, and it's over time, you know, maybe people have come to understand the best way, the most beneficial way to do this tapping. So what does this process look like? What exactly is it?
Essentially the first thing that we do when we want to tap is obviously make sure we have a sugar maple tree. My first year I tapped a basswood thinking it was a maple tree. And
in the interest of full disclosure.
Yeah.
On TV, right?
Yeah, it was on live TV. Yes, the news was there. You live and you learn, right? So I won't do that again. So we make sure we have a maple tree first and foremost. We are then going to test to see if the tree is large enough. So we don't tap any trees that are smaller than 10 inches in diameter, just for the sake of the tree. We don't want to damage it. And then again, is the tree healthy? Is there a lot of limbs missing? Is there holes in the tree? That sort of thing. Bark missing. So once we've established those things and we know we have a maple, then we personally use hand cranked drills or brace drills. So some places we'll use electric drills, just bzz, bzz, right in and out. We do it the old-fashioned way for sake of education, and also a little bit for the sake of the tree. So that slower drilling, it's kind of better for the tree in the way that we're not going to cauterize that hole by going too fast, which will limit the sap flow. And also you're running less risk of actually causing damage to the hole and having leaks around your spile when you put it in. Now, I have seen... Now there are even smaller spiles. So our spile is, I don't know the size of it. It's probably 5/16 or something. And now they do 7/16. And they're a little smaller, and they call them tree savers. And they're just a little smaller. They're better for the tree. It's easier for the tree to heal a smaller hole, right?
Okay.
We've come a long way, and we use metal buckets when we tap and collect. Some places use bags. Or big 5-gallon food safe buckets with tubes running. And then those big productions will have tubes running hundreds of yards through the forest, actually sucking the sap out of the tree and putting it into a really big container. So the way that people do it varies a lot, but we personally kind of do it like in an old-fashioned way.
So. Yeah, I like that. So where on the tree exactly are you tapping? And what determines that? Can you really tap just about anywhere if you're not heading into one of those belly button things you were telling us about earlier?
Yeah, the belly button. So what we do is we find that if it's a tree that we tapped previously, which at Hawthorne Hollow they usually are, every once in a while we have an eye on a tree. They're like, it's got to be the right size, and it finally, this year it's the right size. We can tap it. Doesn't happen often. But we find the belly button because Caitlin said we can't. It's not great for the tree to re-tap that belly button. We wouldn't get a lot of sap flow. It's scar tissue, like she said. So, rule of thumb. We take our thumb, put it on the belly button, and go one hand over, one hand down, or one hand up, and try to find a good spot about, 6 inches away from that belly button.
Oh, okay.
We usually tap on the south side of the tree because when the sun comes up, the sun hits the south side of the, it's always in the southern horizon, and hits the south side of the tree first, warming that up. And warming that tree up kind of gets the sap flowing faster than the other side of the tree, which is sometimes still frozen.
Wow.
Another thing, too, is the height on the tree. I have that question a lot. Is there a certain height on the tree where you're supposed to tap? And really, it doesn't matter. But it's more for the benefit of who's tapping or who's collecting. So me being a shorter person, my taps tend to be a little lower on the tree. And especially when I've got kids, that I'm having out collect, I don't want them to have to reach up to try to collect a bucket. So we tend to go between 3 feet and probably 6 feet on the tree, give or take, probably closer to 3 to 5 or 4 even on the tree. So.
Okay. You already touched on the fact that this should happen at a certain point in the year in terms of that freezing and thawing thing that, for whatever reason, causes the sap to flow and, I suppose, be more accessible. So what do you do to determine when you should start tapping a given tree, especially in a year like this one that climactically has been pretty strange?
Yeah, so the thing you're looking for is that freezing and thawing, and it's all about pattern. So you want there to be a consistent freezing and thawing pattern. If you just have one day where it's freezing at night, but then you get a nice day where it's up in the 40s, that's not enough to justify putting the hole in the tree, because then if the next week or two is all below freezing, you're not going to have any flow, and then that tree will start to heal itself and it'll just stop. So the tap can only be there for so long before the tree just closes it up or slows it down. So this year was, and last year, were really hard decisions for me to make as the person that makes that decision, because when we start tapping, then all the staff gets to help me, right? And in the wintertime, we're doing a lot of planning. We're doing grant writing. And so it's an inconvenience for the trees to be ready at the 1st of February when normally they're ready at the 1st of March, right?
Oh.
So last year we tapped, in 2023, we tapped February 12th. Okay, so that's about 2 weeks before we normally do. This year was a month before. We tapped the first tree February 1st, which was like our tester. It was running right away. So then we tapped the driveway trees on February 3rd. And then we tapped the rest of our production trees on the private side of the property on the 6th. So literally a month before we generally do. I would say on a normal year, we tap like February 28th, like at the end of February or beginning of March. I know there was one year that we didn't start the boil until March 15th, which would mean that we probably didn't tap until March 10th or March 12th or so. So that's late.
Wow.
So it varies a lot. It's very inconsiderate of the weather and the climate to be so all over the
yeah,
place.
Yes.
So
Mother Nature should be a little more cooperative.
Right.
So you're really literally looking at the weather first.
Yes.
And I suppose charting temperatures and making that determination. And then it sounds like you go in with one tree to just see if indeed it is as ready as you are surmising it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And there you go. So when you begin tapping, so first of all, which trees get tapped? I mean, does essentially every maple tree on your property get tapped, or are there some that are out of commission for one reason or another?
So first, Kaylin, she tapped the first trees this year, and I think you went out and did your mass tap on February 3rd this year.
Mm-hmm.
And for convenience of collecting, because these are, you know, like Kaylin said, they're metal buckets and they're 2 gallon buckets. So sometimes those buckets can fill, you know, all the way up in one day, sometimes twice in a day. So for convenience of the collecting, we have the metal buckets on trails or even roads that we can access with the carts, because we go around with these 5 gallon plastic, you know, food grade buckets, and we dump the sap in. So we decide to tap the trees closer first. that was your question, right?
Right. Uh-huh. And take us from there.
Okay, and then the tree has to be a certain size as well. So what we do is a big part of the field trip is making sure that it is indeed a maple tree and it's the right, you know, we can tap this tree. So we have a measuring device that tells us, you know, it's got to be 10 inches or bigger to tap. If it's 9.5 inches, we're going to wait a few more years.
Mm.
You know, so it's got to be the right size tree, and it's got to be a maple tree the right time of year. And, you know, like I said, at the end of the year, we have sometimes over 100 trees tapped, and some of them are pretty far back in. So we've got our army of staff and volunteers that go out, you know, deep into the woods with a handcart sometime, load it with 5 gallon buckets, bringing these buckets back to the sugar shack to filter all the, you know, bugs, ants, flies get into the sap, and we filter it all out there at the sugar shack and dump it into we have a giant stainless steel tank that we got donated from us from Apple Trio over by Apple Trio Winery. Mm. Over by Bong there. They donated to this years ago, but it holds 400 gallons of sap.
Wow.
We fill that up to the top sometimes. It's like a big bathtub. Wow. Full of sap.
Interesting. When you are tapping a given tree, how long does that tapping occur? I mean, and are you, I mean, like, you sticking something in and getting sap out and then you're done, or do you do it like day after day after day? And sitting there waiting for the sap to come out, how long a process is this per tree?
Sure. So the actual tapping you just do once. You put one hole in the tree, and then you're good for about a month.
And how long does that – oh, and so that bucket sits there for a month?
Yes, and we continuously are just emptying that bucket, moving that sap, and it refills itself. So when we get those especially good weather days where it was a hard freeze at night and then it gets up to 50 during the day, like TJ said, it could refill twice in a day.
Wow.
But on average, I'd say they fill up maybe a quarter or halfway per day, at least especially this year. It's not been the best as far as filling up the buckets. But, yeah, you tap it the one time, and then by generally the end of March, which is when we're done with our programs, we will pull those taps out so they can fully heal. But since we started so early, our first trees that we tapped are being very slow, if producing anything at all, because I think that they're already closing up. Those ones are especially more in the sun, so those ones are staying warmer. They're not getting that cold like the forest ones are. So it's super weird this year.
Wow, no kidding. So you collect this sap from these trees and then it all goes into this huge sort of repository thing?
Yeah, there's a stainless steel dairy tank, the one that got donated to us. And from there, there's a tube, a food-grade plastic tube that leads into our evaporator, which is a pretty much a wood-fed stove, an oven. We have a lot of fallen trees. We had all the ash that fell down. So we've got all this – we've got plenty of resource for wood.
Yeah.
We get it as hot as we can and boil it for hours and hours and hours. And when we're boiling it, actually what that's doing – because sap is mostly water, and to make syrup, we have to take that water out and leave the sugars behind. So it's really the evaporation is what everyone's found is just the most efficient way to remove that water.
Hmm.
And some people use what reverse osmosis. There's other methods, but it's fun to sit around and boil for hours and hours at a time, sometimes late into the night.
Yeah. Well, and you use this word evaporator, and I'm picturing this fancy space-age machine.
It sounds fancy, huh?
It really isn't that, though. I mean, it sounds like in that respect, you're also doing it, in a sense, the simplest way, if you will.
So when you think of evaporator, as far as maple sugaring goes, think of a mouse trap maze. You know, put the mouse in, and so the sap goes in here, and it flows around the corner. It's a big stainless steel tray with walls, little hallways for the sap to flow around. The sap enters in one spot where it's just sap, and then it, you know, when it makes its way through the point where we pull it off, at that point it would be. It doesn't happen automatically. It happens over a long time, but we have a measuring tool called a hydrometer, and we make sure that it's pretty close to syrup before we pull it off. It takes a long time, sometimes, 12 hours
of
boiling.
Wow.
And adding more sap.
Or more.
Ah.
So it's a constant drip. So it's not like we put 5 gallons of sap in there and then we boil and then we take that off. We're constantly dripping, so essentially we have an equilibrium of what's evaporating is also what's going in, and eventually you get a more concentrated side and your least concentrated side. So what he was saying about those three sections, it's very complicated if you don't see this, it's the sap is entering in one side, that's the least concentrated. As it cooks, as it boils, the concentration is being pushed because of, I don't know, pressure. I don't know the physics of it, but
right.
It pushes it to the other side. So we have our most concentrated side over here, which is where we draw off to bottle it. So it's really hard to believe even when you talk about it. It's like, how does it know? How does the sap know that it needs to go to that side of the evaporator? So
wow.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff. But the hydrometer really answers questions for us. We're testing that, and that tells us what our sugar content is. So you can look at it, and it'll be brown, and it'll taste good, and it won't look like – and it won't actually be syrup because there's too much water in it still.
Ah.
Or you could go beyond syrup and turn it into candy, or you could burn it. So there's – when you get to the bottling stage, there's a lot of very careful things happening.
Wow. And – So the thing that surprises me is I guess I didn't realize that it goes from sap to syrup. I figured you take the sap, you boil it down or whatever, and then you have to do all this other stuff to turn it into syrup. And it sounds like, no, it just sap becomes syrup when you take it through this careful process.
Yeah, don't add anything to it. Yeah, it's just 100%. Sap boiled down.
Yep.
Yeah.
Wow. So the syrup that you ultimately create at Hawthorne Hollow, is it in a sense all the same? I mean, pretty much. I mean, and you're not flavoring it or doing other things to alter it.
We're not altering it. It's all the same in the way that if you get 100% maple syrup from the store, and it is 100% maple syrup, it's made from the same thing as ours is. It's just sap that's been turned into syrup. There's nothing that's been added. But we, because we're a smaller production, we get this gradation in our color and in our flavor. So even though we're not changing anything, we're not adding anything, the earlier season syrup, because of the content of the sap, is going to be lighter in color. It's going to be almost yellow. It'll be clearer to see through, and it's going to taste more sugary and more buttery, like butter pecan flavor.
Oh.
And that's natural, and that's just because there's other things in the sap that we don't see or really know about that are creating that flavor. And then as the season goes on, it starts to slowly get darker, have more of that classic maple flavor. And then if you go way to the end of the season, too late, like when the trees are already putting out buds, we call that buddy syrup. Or buddy sap, and that tastes like molasses. It's like black, you can't see through it, and it's very bitter. So it changes drastically through the season. But at the store, a lot of times they're mixing all that grade, all the season together, so it all looks one color. But we have different colors. But it's all the same sugar content. When we do the same measuring, it's all the same sugar content. It's just that other stuff that changes how it boils and how it looks.
Right.
So.
And do you find that the nature of the syrup is demonstrably different in a year like this, that climactically was so strange, or does that not particularly affect the way the syrup ultimately looks or tastes?
It doesn't really affect it. It's just when you tap. So obviously, if the weather was right on March 1st, and it wasn't right the whole rest of the season, it was too cold, and then on March 1st, we started having that freezing and thawing, then our first batch would be that yellow color. But for us, the weather was right February 1st, and our first batch was yellow. And so it doesn't matter when in the year that you start, but as long as you start at the beginning of that season or when it's flowing is
right.
When you get that color. Because if you start too late, if I would have waited and held off until the middle of February, we would have started with orange. We wouldn't have had that early season stuff. So that's really the difference. But again, it's all weather. So it doesn't matter what year or what, you know, when we actually start. It's just that pattern. So
interesting. So in a typical year, so first of all, do you already have syrup on the shelf that you're selling?
Yeah, bottles and bottles. It's a fundraiser of ours, and we've got plenty of syrup right now, but we do run out through the seasons. We sell 8-ounce bottles for $12 a bottle. It's a little more than the store, but it's our fundraiser. You know, we're a local nonprofit, and it's our seasonal fundraiser. We usually sell out midway through the summer. Mm-hmm. But we've got a good gradation right now, and if you come and buy the Sugar Shack, maybe give us a call ahead of time if you don't see anybody around. But we've got it for sale there at Hawthorne Hollow.
Yeah. The problem is that he says we have bottles and bottles and bottles. This year is our second worst year so far for production.
In terms of amount.
Yes. So 2018 was our best year. We did 560 bottles or 35 gallons of syrup. So that's 1,400 gallons of sap that we collected that year.
Wow.
If you do the math, and that's considering if we didn't accidentally dump some sap buckets or something, you know.
Right.
But this year, I think right now we currently have 90 bottles of syrup. We've already sold some, but I want to say we only have about 90 left, and the season's not over yet, but it's very, very close to being over. And in history, our worst season so far was 2021, and we had 204 bottles. So we're very close to being the worst year this year. So this is the year to get it. I mean, we do have that great gradation and great flavor this year, but it is definitely limited. And that's also a reason for, you know, it's not only a fundraiser, but it's also a ton of work. And it helps support the educational programming. So
absolutely,
it's definitely worth it. And it makes you feel good about eating your pancakes.
Of course. And and as you say, it will go quickly this year. There's this the cupboard will be bare before we know it. So TJ, as someone who's done this as long as you have, has the way it's done at Hawthorne Hollow changed very much over the years, or by and large, is the maple sugaring process pretty much as you remember it from the first time you did it, way back before Kaylin was even born, probably?
No.
No, not quite.
So, yeah, things have changed bit by bit. You know, it's all about finding the best way to do things, just like in every you know, part of life. But we have, you know, found more efficient ways to do things, to collect the sap, to evaporate, even to teach the classes. It hasn't changed. You know, it's still maple sap we're dealing with. We're still tapping the same trees, but it hasn't changed a ton. Every year we try to, you know, add something else to maybe the program or maybe the sugar shack itself to, you know, make it a little different or just to add on to making things a little more appealing or better. But yeah, it's essentially the same as it was back in 2012. Although that sugar shack from 2011 to 2012 was a game changer.
Right, I'm sure it was. Where exactly is that on the property of Hawthorne Hollow? I mean, do we easily see it when we visit Hawthorne Hollow?
Yeah, you know, when you pull into the main parking lot there by the Nature Center, the brick building, it's in the back. So in the back of the Nature Center there, on the north side of the building, it's a red shack with ventilation on top and a chimney coming out. And if it's, you know, if it's March, you'll probably see smoke coming out of the chimney and steam coming out of that ventilation.
Wow. Very good. Very good. So once this season is over, and as you said, it's just about over, then do you have nothing to do with the maple trees except to just look at them? I mean, is there anything that has to be done in the off season, so to speak?
Not really, mostly just planning on my part. So once we will pull the taps out by the end of the field trip season, and we just kind of let the maples heal themselves back up to prepare for next year. But a lot of it is planning on my part. So the field trip program is the most popular field trip program that we have at Hawthorne Hollow. I have field trips every single day, sometimes 3-4 groups in a day, where I need, again, my staff to help me, which is so amazing. During the winter, I am trying to find support, so I'm writing grants. And so this past year, I actually happened to get a grant from the Kenosha Community Foundation, their CBK grant, to help support the program. So thank you to them. They allow us to, you know, get new supplies for the kids and make it so that it's easier on us as a nonprofit to be able to offer this to them and make it more accessible to them. But I want to say last year I had 1,500... No, that's probably for the year. I probably get groups of, oh man, I don't have a number. Never mind. I'm not gonna say it because I don't want to be off. But I get a lot of students for maple sugaring. So
many hundreds.
Yes, and so during the program, we're identifying the maple trees too, and so it is cool. After the season, there's kids that come back with their families, and they're now able to identify maple trees in the forest. So and then they get to actually see them with leaves and see them, you know, throughout the season, and that's very. Very cool for me and hopefully for them too. So the maples are serving a purpose all year round, but it's just during March, it's really for us. But right. The rest of the time of the year, it's for nature, it's for the kids, it's
sure.
for education.
For
so.
Beauty. Very yeah. good. Well, it's been so fun to kind of learn about this whole process that, and again, I say for those of us who just mindlessly pour on our syrup on our pancakes, we just don't really think very much about what all goes into it. So.
I just want to note, too, when you say people pouring their syrup on their pancakes, it's a lot of the syrup at the store is not 100% maple syrup. Mm. So it's a lot of corn syrup being added in. A lot of times they don't say maple syrup. It'll say breakfast syrup or pancake syrup, but it won't, or just syrup, but right. it won't say 100% maple syrup, and that's the difference. Real maple syrup is a little thinner. It's not quite as thick because it's not made with corn syrup.
Sure.
We kind of tell this story. I'm in an online group of backyard maple sugarers, and someone wanted their real maple syrup to be thicker, like the store stuff, so they put gelatin in it.
Oh.
And they ended up with maple Jello.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, you shouldn't mess with it. Then it's not 100% maple syrup if you do additives. So, you know, that's something that I like to also pound in is that it's a lot of work to get the real stuff, and, right. and the real stuff is not the same as the store stuff. So.
And the real stuff is worth it.
Yes, it is.
Absolutely. So there are a few bottles of syrup at Hawthorne Hollow that are on sale to the general public, and pay Hawthorne Hollow a visit. There's all kinds of things, of course, to see and enjoy there. Kaylin Palomares is on the staff there as naturalist and education manager, and we've also been so pleased and honored to have the executive director, TJ Levesque, with us as well. Thank you so much for stepping in and for helping to tell the story of maple sugaring at Hawthorne Hollow. Well,
thanks for having me, Kaylin and Greg. Thank you.
Great. All right, Kaylin, before we finish up, I know you have several announcements you want to share with our listeners.
Yeah, so... Again, to keep it on theme, there's a lot of maple sugaring programs going on in the area. Obviously, Hawthorne Hollow, we have our maple sugaring time classes this Saturday at 10 and 1. You can register for that on the website. But other than that, Pringle Nature Center also does a maple syrup hike at Petrifying Springs. Mm-hmm. That's happening this Saturday at 10 a.m. and 11:30 a.m. Registration is on their website as well. We're great friends with them, and they come out to Pets, I think, to make it more accessible for people to learn about it, too. So we're happy with that. River Bend obviously does their sugar and off pancake breakfast on Sundays in March. So that's open from 8 to 12. You don't have to register. You can just show up, eat some pancakes, some sausage, and go to their stations and learn a little bit about the process. And I just found out that in Lake Geneva, Covenant Harbor is doing a maple fest this Sunday on March 17th from 7:30 to 2. There's going to be pancakes. There's an outdoor market and family activities related to maple sugaring. So
fantastic.
Some really great stuff going on. We're lucky in this area to have, you know, the climate and the ability to do maple sugaring. So I'm happy to see that so many places are offering things.
It's great to see. And this was a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much. And we look forward to seeing you in April.
Thanks, Greg.
All right. Very good. Kaylin Palomares. Tomorrow on the morning show, we look forward to welcoming to the program for the very first time Dr. Lynn Akey, who is the chancellor at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. She began there back in January. And by the way, her counterpart at Carthage, Dr. John Swallow, the president of Carthage College, is my morning show guest on Monday. Today, as you surely already know, is a cloudy, breezy, rainy, chilly day. A high today of just 46 degrees. Cloudy and windy overnight with a low of 36. But tomorrow, Friday, should be sunny and warming to a high of 51 degrees. Mid-50s for a high on Saturday. Back into the 40s for a high on Sunday, and down into the mid-30s for a high on Monday. This is W.